Good morning and welcome back to a brand new episode where we will continue discussing environmental issues and their social consequence. Can big data help us understand the global land rush? That's a question I want to answer with you together this morning. Before we dig right in, I want to make sure that we have the same understanding. Now, a global land rush means large-scale land acquisitions in developing countries by investors. These investors can be companies, governments, or individuals that engage in land deals. That means that countries such as China that struggle to produce their own food within their country buy or lease land for the production of food or biofuels in developing countries. That means they acquire foreign territory through the purchase, lease, or concession. They obtain the right to use, control, or own land in developing countries. Now, this practice should concern us all, because that food production made with these land deals is not for the local population, but exclusively for the whole market. Now, we know that many countries, especially in Africa, they have a shortage of food. In fact, many African countries are heavily dependent on European agricultural imports. So this indeed is a policy challenge on how to respond to these land deals that basically entail that developing countries give up part of their territory to capital-rich countries so that they can produce their own food or biofuels over there. The global land rush is also called new colonialism and a modern-day version of the 19th century scramble for Africa. A big hype of that term started in 2007 after a dramatic rise in the global food prices. Interestingly enough, the actors involved in the debate over the global land rush can be divided into two groups. The first are investors and international organizations like the World Bank that applaud land grabs because they claim it brings in new flows of land investments. They say that empty land in host countries, such as in Africa, can financially benefit because in the end, economic growth is sparked because empty land turns into productive land. And they claim that investment also brings employment and technology. The opposite camp, the second group involved in this debate, has a much more critical opinion on the land grabs. This voice are mainly development organizations that criticize this practice. They claim that local communities are actually made worse off, especially with regards to human rights. Big data enthusiasts claim that some of the biases and flaws that characterize field research can be avoided by using data sets with ever greater volume, velocity, and variety. They place hope in big data as it makes research faster, easier, and allows to formulate new research questions. In fact, some even claim that field research would no longer be needed with big data because correlations can just be identified in the numbers. Traditional field research have taught us quite a few things about land deals. Case studies have shown that investors were not only from the east, but also from the north. So it was not just China, but also European countries like Germany that engaged into these land deals. Further, it weren't just the greedy international companies that were involved, but also domestic ones and joint ventures. Finding on the ground also showed that not all large-scale land acquisitions can be labeled as grabs. Many are actually legal land deals, and some domestic governments actually promote them However, the authors claim that the term land grab may still be appropriate, because even if land deals are legal, several illegal things often happen within the process of the land acquisition. Field research has also shown us that land grabs often go hand in hand with conflicts. It is important to notice that many of the field research reports contain significant errors. Stories about land grabs were easily accepted as conventional wisdoms, and there was little proof checking or follow-up investigations. Empirical insights, thanks to big data, has helped us understand the gravity of the problem. In fact, more than 1,000 land deals were reported as concluded within the last years. Empirical evidence has also shown that the development impacts of land deals are often very limited. In few instances, employment is generated, but if so, working conditions are generally poor and local people are excluded. Hence, land deals often lead to a rise in exploitation and poverty. Further, local people are shown to be often displaced without proper consultation information. By browsing the Google's historic database, we can also see that land was not always labeled a global good. A global good that's necessary to supply food and energy on a world scale. Another difference we can see is the relevance of environmental issues. Thankfully, these are much higher today. Many people find data boring. Others are simply overwhelmed by all the numbers. They don't know how to interpret it. And that's fair enough. In fact, that's why often big data is visualized. The Land Metrics platform, for example, does this kind of visualization. The Land Metrics platform lists hundreds and thousands of deals of land grabbing and the size of land that were involved in these deals. However, it has been criticized because it draws the attention away from core issues of land grabbing. There are a few problems. First, it combines observations from different sources with varying degrees of reliability and verifiability. Secondly, it does differentiate between target countries, but not within the country itself. The reality is that most investments are spatially located, for example, to areas within a country that have good infrastructure access, but the database does not distinguish between regions of a country. Thirdly, no details are provided for geographical circumstances, so it's unclear if the land grab involve the forest area or empty lands in the middle of nowhere. Lastly, there are no indicators of the consequence of land grabbing, such as a number of affected people. The researcher Oya Edelman has called this a fetishization of the hectare. She and many others criticize that this data fetish makes it all about the size of land, but it's not. Many more significant issues are ignored. The size of land, yeah, it kind of matters, but what about the capital applied? What about the control of supply chain or the labor relations? The land metrics kind of creates misperceptions and diverts attention from the real issue by focusing only on quantifiable datasets. Now, I don't know who of you guys heard about the Google Books Ngram Viewer, but it's a tool, it's an online search engine that lets you go through millions of books over time, and you can see how terms have evolved. Resorting to the dataset, one can see that land rush is not a new trend that emerged recently from the food and energy crisis. No, it's a term that has been used in different times and settings. For example, in the 19th century, to talk about the occupation of territory from the Indians and other Native Americans. Comparing the current situation of the land rush with the expulsion of Native Americans in the Wild West, We understand that the land rush is a continuation of old myths about empty and wasted lands. So now we have already talked about the empirical insights that were generated thanks to big data. We also talked about how Google implements big data in its Ngram tool. Just before, we talked about the problems with visualizing big data. Now, I want to quickly summarize how big data can be used to analyze communication. When it comes to the global land rush, the authors have searched for the network between stakeholders in the debate and investigated their communication. They identified the most relevant actors and 100 hyperlinks that they share with one another. This co-occurrence of hyperlinks shows how often they quote one another. The analysis revealed that there's a tight network with many mutual links centered around the UN organizations and the World Bank. Now, these formal institutions apparently cite each other a lot. They're very engaged with one another. The second group, mainly consisting of NGOs and activists, they have far fewer links. They seem to communicate less with one another and even less with the first group, the formal UN organizations. Interestingly enough, these two groups don't communicate directly, but only through so-called bridging groups. So these are actors that quote both the formal organizations and the NGOs and activists. This analysis has great policy relevance. Now it's clear that if you want to reach out to all relevant stakeholders, you may want to consider talking to actors that are part of this bridging group and not only to formal UN organizations or to activist NGOs. Interestingly enough, the analysis also indicates that businesses, academic institutions, and organizations of the South are not apparent at all in the network. To make their voice heard too, they should reach out more to other stakeholders involved in the debate. Now, this communication analysis has great policy relevance. It illustrates that the network of stakeholders in this debate is quite divided. If you would want to contribute to the debate, you should probably reach out to the bridging group that has contact with both the formal UN organizations and the activist NGOs. Another relevant finding is that businesses, academic institutions, and organizations of the South are not really represented at all. They should really step up their effort if they want to make their voice heard in the debate. Now this is it. Can big data now help us understand the global land rush? What's our conclusion? Well, I think it's safe to say that big data does enable us to see new things that were formerly invisible. For example, that the term land rush is nothing new. A great benefit of big data is that it helps us study linkages and networks easier and with less time. However, we have also seen that a pure quantification may lead to wrong conclusions. A broader critical discussion of what is being reported is necessary. To secure confidence in the data, it's indispensable that researchers make sure that they have the right quality and reliability of data. They need to know the sources and the method used that generated this data sets. To me, it's clear that human and environmental implications cannot be assessed with simple numbers of land deals or the hectare size involved. No, numbers need to be put into context. Statistics do not speak for themselves. This is why field research is still necessary. We need to understand local context and be able to interpret it. Big data is powerful because it provides us with so much information. However, it's also somewhat overwhelming. We need to make sure that data is interpreted and evaluated responsibly. Local populations and experts should not be excluded from this analysis. Now, thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you learned more about the global land rush and why foreign land acquisition is a policy problem that really needs to be expressed. I also hope that I sensibilized you for the big data challenges, the risks, and of course also the benefits it incorporates. I look forward to hear for your feedback. Until our next episode, stay curious, stay engaged, and stay tuned for further news.